Seattle's Morning News. A Renton man is behind bars, accused of pointing a gun at an artist who was working on a community mural. We have a live report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Yeah, Dave, so the city of Renton had hired this artist to do a mural. It was basically to represent the particular community that was in and represent the diversity in the community. And the artist had been working on it for some time, but there was several incidents. Gary Ernstorf is with the King County Prosecutor's Office.
In the last week of September, a car drove by a number of occasions, and the occupant was yelling things like, "All lives matter, Trump." You know, it caused the artist and a couple of the assistants some concern. It came to a crux, I suppose, on September 29th when the car stopped. The artist went over to perhaps find out what was going on and what was causing anger, and the driver of the vehicle pulled out a semi-automatic handgun and racked around and racked the slide back, and the artist was terrified. Fled behind her equipment. She believed she was going to be shot.
Now, the driver took off. About 2 weeks later, that mural was vandalized, causing about $2,500 in damage. It had the red spray paint over it. It said Trump, and along with the initials LAM and Boo, B-O-O. Cops investigated. There was surveillance video, but it was really bad quality, so they couldn't identify anybody off of it. Later, an investigation showed that those letters, LAM, had also been spray painted that same day at a nearby pet food store in the area. So they were able to match that up, and cops had a witness who had provided a partial license plate that they were able to match to the same guy in that gun incident.
He was located and arrested at his apartment nearby the mural. Search warrants were served on his residence and vehicle, and the police recovered a can of red spray paint and a semi-automatic pistol that matched the description provided by the victim.
So this is a 49-year-old guy. He had his first appearance in court yesterday, and the for malicious mischief is what they are going to charge him with, as well as assault 2. He's being held on $150,000 bail. Now, the fear caused by having a gun pointed at you is what rose to that level of assault here.
I think the fear was really compounded. I mean, any time a firearm's used, you're going to create a lot of fear. But I think it was compounded by the number of incidents that preceded that, this building anger. I mean, I have to say, I think it's a sad example of the divisiveness that we see far too often occurring in our community and, frankly, all over the nation. And I have grave concerns that it may not go away quietly.
And what he's talking about there is we were discussing that perhaps it would go away after the election, all of this divisiveness. And he and many others that I talked to don't necessarily think so.
Well, that's concerning. So apparently the guy just didn't like seeing that mural in his neighborhood, huh?
That appears to be it. And so the working theory is that it was not a Black Lives Matter mural, but it did represent diversity in that community. So a lot of different kind of communities represented in the mural that was being painted. So the belief is that he may have thought that it was a Black Lives Matter representation because he's accused of saying all lives matter so many times, and that's kind of the counter to the Black Lives Matter.
Is in a public space or where the mural is located?
Yeah, it's along a wall right out there in the open in the neighborhood in Renton.
Okay. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, to join us, as he does every Friday morning, for All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind local places and things. And Sunday marks 90 years since a giant waterfront landmark and nighttime beacon for ships was first switched on in downtown Seattle. And that would be?
Well, we're not talking about the Elephant Car Wash sign.
No.
That's a big sign. But this long-gone neon landmark we're talking about is huge. It was a sign that said Port of Seattle in letters that range from 18 to 22 feet high. They were mounted on metal framework that was 30 feet tall. Port and Seattle were straight, but of was set off at a jaunty little angle in between. Now, here are the measurements, which are crazy. 320 feet long. That's a football field, including the end zones.
Wow.
And it used 1,500 feet of neon tubing. Now, the big letters were on top of the old Bell Street Terminal at what's now Pier 66. Huh. It's now the Bell Street Cruise Terminal. The letters were white, so the sign was white and reflective during the day. And the double neon tubes were red, so it lit up red at night. Now, the port leases from a company called General Illumination for $170 a month back right at the dawn of the Great Depression. Now, it was first lit up on October 25th, 1930. That's 90 years ago this Sunday. It was described as the biggest neon sign in Washington and one of the biggest marine displays in the world. I don't know what a marine display is, but it's nice to be able to claim it's one of the biggest ones in the world.
Yes.
And it was kind of a big hit right away. It also became a navigation landmark. If you look on old nautical charts going back to the 1930s, it's shown as an aid to navigation. It's even mentioned in the official U.S. Pacific Coast Pilot and described as a handy way to find the city at night. Now, I grew up seeing this sign all the time, but I never saw it in person. But it used to be in the opening sequence of this awesome nighttime Seattle footage that used to air before something called the Foremost movie on Como TV. That's Foremost, spelled like the number four.
I get it.
I don't know. Remember when TV stations had programs named after their channel? Como had Foremost. King had the five star. Cairo had the Big Seven movie. Now, and it was this beautiful opening sequence. And I think that ran sometime to the late 70s after the sign had already gone away. And it did have a good long run. By March 1972, there were news in the Seattle Times saying that several pieces of the letters had burned out and the sign had generally kind of fallen on hard times. And so by early 1973, the Port of Seattle decided to take it down. They'd gotten estimates to fix it. One was $100,000, which would be about $600,000 in 2020 dollars.
That's a lot.
And City of Seattle codes had changed about sign near highways, and the viaduct was down there. And they estimated the removal was something around $7,500, but the winning bid came in just over $3,000. And I don't have the exact date, but sometime in March or April of 1973, that big sign came down. Now, the Times article said that they were going to store it in the basement of Bell Street Terminal. Now, I'm no architect or maritime expert, but I don't think any of those pier buildings have basements. So I don't know if that was a snarky joke or not. I checked with Peter McGraw at the Port of Seattle yesterday. He's convinced the sign is long gone. He doesn't think it was necessarily stored anywhere. He also shared some really cool photographs. You have to see this sign to believe it. It was just huge. And we'll have those at My Northwest a little bit later on. And I also found a newspaper article from the 1940s talking about mountain climbers over in the Olympics looking back toward the city at night and being able to see this
sign. To see the sign?
Yeah.
So are you going to launch another crusade to try to find the missing pieces and reassemble it?
Well, you know, when you work on a story like this and you don't know all the facts, all the details, there is a part in the back of your mind that wonders, mm-hmm. Where did it go? Did it just end up in a scrapyard?
Well, you found the Bon Marché star, so why not the sign?
Yeah, bring back the Port of Seattle sign. It would only cost probably $100 billion to do it right in 2020. Yeah, it's worth every penny.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks, Dave.
Washington, D.C., that's where we find Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan, who has this assessment of the final presidential debate of 2020.
More civil, less food fight, more debate. The answers were at best generic, but at least we got a flavor of the agenda items for the two candidates. The format helped. President Trump wasn't interrupting Joe Biden and talking over him the way he did in that first debate, which was widely panned. That helped Joe Biden hold on to his temper. He didn't this time tell the president to just shut up, man, as he did the first time around. So we're improving off of a disastrous first time out. But I think primarily for both candidates, this was about not doing harm to their campaigns. And I think they both can walk away saying that.
Yeah, I think Trump wanted to give the latest Giuliani allegations against Biden some traction. Do you think he succeeded?
Well, that certainly was a big focus. As you saw, there was even the stunt before the debate began with a former business partner of Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, came out and came to the debate site and made more allegations. But it was interesting because obviously Joe Biden was prepared for this to be a line of attack, and he kind of tried to go there himself. This seemed to be a tactical move when he brought up Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney, on his own, introducing the topic on his own terms. And that, in terms of the Biden campaign folks, certainly they thought that helped the former vice president kind of own an issue. But also what I thought was interesting is Joe Biden held his temper, which he did not do just a few days prior when a CBS News reporter just asked him to comment on the story mm-hmm. itself. So this was a raw nerve, and Joe Biden was prepared for this to be a line of attack and tried to pivot back and say, this isn't about my family, the president's family. It's about your family. It's about the virus. So tried to bring it back to the news cycle that most Americans are paying attention to, which is their own health.
The other last-minute story was Trump's Chinese bank account. Do you think, and he said, yes, I had a bank account there. I closed it out before I became president. It's something you do when you're a businessman trying to mm-hmm. do business in China. Do you think he answered that?
He certainly tried to. It was a more fulsome answer than the White House has given, but look, the best counterpoint that perhaps the Democrats have lobbed back throughout the campaign is, okay, if everything is fine and dandy and above board, show the transparency of your own financial records through your tax records over the past few years and decades, as Joe Biden has done, because if there were allegations of corruption and pocketing money, that should be showing up somewhere in those financial records. The president continued to say, I can't, I'm under audit. But as we know, that doesn't prevent you from releasing yourself your tax returns.
Yesterday here in Washington State, we got a report that one third of the eligible voters have already voted. And looking at some of the modeling going on around the country, it's clear that this early voting seems to be heavily Democratic. But there's also a warning with that, not to get too cocky.
That's right. That's exactly right. 47 million Americans was the latest number I saw have already cast their votes early. Some of that at the polls, most of that through mail. The mail portion of that is where this will get complicated, because in many key states, you can't actually start tabulating those ballots, counting them, until election day. So casting your vote early doesn't necessarily mean earlier results for the election. And in fact, you may on election night. And this is one of the things that I think is it's incumbent upon us as reporters and correspondents to explain and be transparent with viewers about. You may see the exit polls of those who physically went to the polls on November 3rd, those results come in faster than the tabulated ballots. Why does that matter? Well, the tendency appears to be if you're Republican, you're going in person. And if you're a Democrat, you went by mail. So you may see a shift in terms of what appears to be a lead earlier in the night that later in the night or perhaps later in the week changes. So getting a definitive read on who is winning may be a bit more complicated because we already expect this to be a litigated election.
The practice here in Washington State has always been to release the already counted ballots at 8 o'clock our time straight up. Mm-hmm. So you get a big chunk of ballots then, and then the rest of them peter in over the following week. So, yeah, it could be a while.
Yeah, you've got much more experience doing this than so many of the states that are trying for the first time. And then for some of them who had kind of disastrous primaries when it was their first time out. So there's a lot of apprehension. There's a lot of litigation. There's already over 300 lawsuits in states around the country about this. So expect the campaigns and the parties to really pain. We may be talking for days and weeks about signatures and drop-off ballots and all sorts of things like that.
Yes, your daily dose of kindness. It is brought to you by Mike Novak and List with Novak.com. Of course, Christmas is coming, and for some families, it's going to be tough to get presents under the tree this year. The pandemic has sent us into an economic crisis, and not everyone has extra money for shopping. So a church in Alabama is stepping up to help kids in need get new backpacks full of Christmas gifts. Michelle Logan with CBS 42 reports from Alabama.
The Chilton County Baptist Association is holding its annual Christmas backpack drive. Backpacks are being collected through next week. They'll be filled with things like toys, food, and art supplies, and will be given to kids and teenagers for the holidays. This annual project got started in 2012. Tyler Island with the Chilton Baptist Association says they're halfway to their goal of 250 backpacks.
Some areas where there's lower income areas in the past where children just don't have access to fun things like what's included in these backpacks. And so it's just awesome to think about the impact it can have in a child's life, to just let them know, hey, somebody cares, somebody wants to help them, somebody loves them.
Backpacks to the Chilton Baptist Association is Monday, but the drive is also going on statewide through next week. And the statewide goal is 12,000 backpacks.
And you know that this is going to be happening in Washington and other places around the country. I'm so glad that people are stepping up, you know, during this pandemic to help get kids Christmas gifts and, you know, just help them remember that things are okay. So we'll tell you when things are happening here
completely
in Washington. Yeah.
Yeah, you need something to provide encouragement when you haven't got the friendship of kids at school. And crossing our fingers that once that vaccine gets out, it all snaps back to normal. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon right here on Cairo Radio. Here he is, having recovered from his debate hangover, G. Scott.
Hey, we're talking Seahawks, though.
We're talking Seahawks, yes. Undefeated Seahawks going up against the Cardinals, who lassoed the Cowboys last week and yanked them off their horses. So it looks like they've got some momentum.
Yeah. And when you talk about momentum, like this Arizona Cardinals team is this. I've been telling you guys about this game, this upcoming game, for a little while now. I'm nervous about every Seahawks game. I want to be clear. Yes. But this one, because this is a division game. This right. is Kyler Murray as the quarterback. Dave, he's a little cartoon character, man. He runs like Fred Flintstone or something. You know what I mean? Just just be running all over the place. So he's
and if he gets flattened by the defense, he just pops back into shape.
I hope so. Yeah, he's dynamic as a quarterback. They have one of the best wide receivers in the game. The offense is really good. And now, as of last week against the Dallas Cowboys, homegrown Buda Baker, from born and raised here in this area, was absolutely phenomenal for the Arizona Cardinals, and I felt like it just kind of sparked them a little bit. By the way, Buda Baker kind of reminds me of Lawyer Malloy back in those days. But this Arizona Cardinals team is good, and I always feel a little bit funny about the Seahawks going down to Arizona, especially that stadium. I'm not a fan of that stadium, and a lot of Seahawks fans aren't. I mean, as we know, that's where the Super Bowl loss happened against the Patriots, Super Bowl 49, on that field. That was the last time that we saw Richard Sherman as a Seahawk.
So you're superstitious.
Play a game on that. I'm maybe a little stitious, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're superstitious. You're not just medium-stitious. You are superstitious.
So again, look, the Seahawks are undefeated. They're coming off a bye week. They're going down there. So far, Jamal Adams has not practiced this week. So looking forward to maybe getting him back. So we'll see. With Michael Kendricks, he is now back. If you remember that name, he was a linebacker with the Seahawks. He was gone. Now he is back. He just got re-signed. So I think right so far the Achilles heel that everybody's talking about is how will this defense get it done week after week, and we'll see what happens on Sunday.
But this game wasn't supposed to be on Sunday, right?
No, it was supposed to be Sunday night.
But wasn't there
was a Sunday night?
To Sunday.
It got flexed to Sunday night
because there was a COVID outbreak on the Raiders or something.
That I wasn't sure on where it happened. I thought it got flexed because it's a good game, but I did. it's a good game, but I did before coming on. I think James was telling me that there was a COVID outbreak, and I just didn't find out about that.
Well, no, that's okay. It is hard to keep up because I feel like we always hear about some outbreaks, but then the games are still being played. I don't know. It's a lot. It is a lot to keep up with, for sure, if you're tracking COVID outbreaks in the NFL.
It definitely is. And I'm glad you bring this up. I mean, the fact that the Seahawks are playing Sunday night prime time, that's good news, right? Everybody that follows the Seahawks knows they actually do pretty good on prime time and Sunday night games and things. So that'll be
something. They love the high stakes. So what's your prediction? Let's hear it. Come on.
I think it's going to be a shootout.
So 35
I think it's going to be 31-27
Seahawks.
31-27 Seahawks. I think they are going to get it done. And so here, one more thing I want to say. This is what's important about this game. They're coming off the bye week, right? And people are saying, oh, okay, you should be relaxed. Well, just remember, ladies and gentlemen, how are you when you first come back from vacation?
Right.
Sometimes you could be too relaxed. So a game after the bye week is really important. So for the Seahawks to go ahead and take care of business and get this win, especially on the road, that puts them at 6-0, coming back for another home game. That puts them in the driver's seat. That really helps them.
That would be crazy.
So that's the thing about NFL football. It's a game of runs, right? It's about peaking at the right time. Right now, the Seahawks have definitely peaked the first few games of the season.
G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock on Car Radio. Thanks, G.
Thanks, guys.
31-27. Seattle, Portland, and New York City are taking on the Trump administration in court over their designation as anarchist jurisdictions. And have you ever worried about what surveillance technologies the Seattle police use? This would be your chance to weigh in with the details on all that. Here's Car Radio's Hannah Scott.
We'll start off with the lawsuit. This was a complaint filed yesterday by the cities of New York, Seattle, Portland about their designation by U.S. Attorney General William Barr earlier as anarchist jurisdiction. That's, of course, related to the various protests and the response that the cities have had to those type of events. Of course, the CHOP and all of that. They announced this yesterday, and they're asking the judge to remove that anarchist jurisdiction labeling, first of all, and then ensure that they can, you know, block this effort to withhold funding, because the federal government and the Trump administration has said that they might withhold the federal dollars because of this anarchist jurisdiction to all federal grants. And in the announcement yesterday, the attorney for New York City said that the Trump administration has now taken concrete steps and started using that anarchist designation in applications for these federal grants. They say there's no basis in law, it's all very illegal, and it's causing a lot of uncertainty in their budgets. If you read the complaint, they don't know, are they going to risk go ahead and keep paying for the things that they usually use the grant dollars for and then have that money not show up. Either way, it's a lose-lose situation. But what I wanted to do was talk to some of the people who are affected by that. So I got a chance yesterday to talk with Lauren McGowan. She's with the United Way of King County, one of several local groups that benefit from the federal dollars.
Deeply concerned about any reduction in services during this really challenging time for our region. Currently, we have about $5 million in CARES Act funded rental assistance and food security services just in the city of Seattle. We have $20 million of additional funds outside of Seattle for the rest of the county. And all of those dollars are going right now to meet basic needs for individuals that have been impacted by COVID-19 and the subsequent layoffs and high rates of unemployment.
And that's not all.
In addition to CARES Act funding, there's funding that supports tax preparation services for families, food access resources, and many of the housing programs that are keeping people in their homes or helping people exit homelessness. And we know that these are such challenging times that not only do we need these funds, nobody needs the stress of worrying about whether there's going to be funding cuts at some time in the future.
And, you know, she wants to stay out of the politics of it all, but she had this message for everybody involved.
The reality is the size of the need is so big, and local government and philanthropy can't do it alone. So I strongly encourage all of us to link arms at this moment in time and realize that we are in an unprecedented time, and we need our elected officials and community members to come together and ensure that these threats aren't followed through with, and that we continue to have not only the dollars we have today, but we need significantly more federal dollars in order to help our community respond to and recover from this crisis.
And I also had a chance to talk to a small business owner in Seattle. She has an art gallery in Seattle. She received some help with her business when the pandemic hit because she was going to shut it down. She was struggling, and there was some grant money that the city had, and she was able to benefit from that. And on top of benefiting her own business, this was kind of cool. She said she was able to use that money to buy the things she needed for her own business, but she bought them locally and therefore benefited other businesses. So it kind of spread out, if you will, rippled out to many different businesses in Seattle. But she says if they aren't able to continue that moving forward, she could decide to shut down. So,
well, so at this point, why would they cut off the United Way? Is the threat to cut off federal grants just all federal grants, regardless of what it goes to?
Yes. Well, and it's already starting to come up in certain. They've started to include that anarchist designation in applications for federal grants. That's what the lawyer in New York City said yesterday. And then the complaint that was filed, they also point to the Federal Transit Administration's announcement earlier this month that it was going to consider applications for a COVID-19 public transportation research grant based on that anarchist designation. So it's just starting to kind of show up everywhere. That's why they decided to act yesterday and hopefully block it from happening. You know, who knows if it actually gets pulled, because that hasn't happened in the past, but we'll see.
Okay, now on police surveillance, tell me more about this. They're going to have some kind of public meeting on modes of surveillance that the police intend to use?
So, yeah, this is an ongoing thing. I don't know if you remember back in, I believe it was 2017, Seattle passed, I believe it's a, you know, kind of the model for the nation, this surveillance ordinance. There's a lot of pushback from the ACLU about the various surveillance technologies that cities use, and they want to make sure that it's just not, you know, running away and that people's privacy isn't getting trampled all over while we were trying to catch up. So the city now has this process where they put out the impact reports that go to the city council. Part of that is the public comment period. Bruce Harrell was a big champion of this before. The former council member, he talked about the importance of this ordinance before he left office.
I think it's important when we start talking about privacy needs to also understand that the surveillance technology is not so much intended to invade on privacy as it is to protect people. We only use technology for that which we need. In other words, we're not overusing it. The easy access to get personal information on people. The city takes even more precautions to make sure that they are a leader in protecting privacy. And so that's why we started doing this kind of work. I want the residents to feel assured that we have their best interests at our heart in our policy decisions.
So this is group three that they're in right now. They've done two reports on other technologies already, but the specific issues that they're asking for some public input on right now are SPD used surveillance technologies. One's a forward-looking infrared real-time video. It kind of provides some aerial photography and digital video for their outdoor locations for disasters and crime scenes. There's a video recording systems one that's, they use that when they're doing like a blood alcohol collection for DUIs back at the station, precinct holding cells, interview rooms, lineup rooms, things like that. And then there's a situational awareness camera that don't record, but it's a technology. These are portable cameras that allow officers to look around corners and other areas during operations where they need to do that. So
it's like drone cameras?
I'm not sure because I haven't seen the full report on this yet. But, there's they definitely record and take things. And I don't think that, I think it's above my pay grade. So that's the idea here is to get people to understand what they are and they'll be able to do that. So I want to make sure I know we're short on time. That public comment period is now open. It opened yesterday and it goes through November 14th. There's a couple of different ways you can find it on the City of Seattle's website, but there's going to be on the 28th, next week at noon, there's a virtual meeting where people can get involved and kind of have a back and forth with this, the city group that's in charge of this to learn more about this and weigh in and that public comment period.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my
bell. Rachel Bell. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Chris Sullivan and Lacey Evans, who's in for Colleen. And here's Rachel Bell, who saw the story about the Pope willing to give his blessing to civil unions between gay people. Are you shocked by that?
I was not shocked by that because we all know he's the cool Pope. He's CP. I think it was only about a month ago or maybe a little bit more that Pope Francis announced that he thinks it's perfectly acceptable to enjoy sex and to enjoy food, that neither of those things are a sin. This next, I don't want to say decree because it wasn't something he decreed.
No.
It was just something he kind of said in conversation, was caught in a documentary he was in that's called Francesco, which debuted at the Rome Film Festival. And he supported same-sex civil unions in the documentary by saying, quote, "What we have to create is a civil union law. That way they are legally covered. Homosexuals have a right to be a part of the family." And then in another part in the documentary, he said, "They're children of God and have the right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or be made miserable because of it."
I'm not sure what he means by "we need a civil union law," but by "we," does he mean the Catholic Church? Is he just using a general collective term? That's what I don't understand. I think it's going to be a long time before you're going to see gay weddings in Catholic churches. That would probably divide the Catholic Church as it has other Christian churches. But on accepting gay unions, you know, he's about, 20 years late on this, which is not unusual for the Catholic Church, which moves pretty slowly.
Yeah.
But the watershed moment for me came when I was at a meeting at one of the churches in Seattle. It was a meeting of Catholic parents of gay kids. And they were, as I remember, fairly conservative on the issue, right? Until it turned out that one of their own children was gay. And then they found themselves in the position of having their church essentially tell them that their child was going to hell, which they couldn't accept. And pastors, many pastors came around saying, yeah, that the church is not here to break up families. It's here to solidify families and bring people together. And that's when things started to change. And so it's reassuring that it's finally reached Rome.
It's really hard to talk about these things for me or just to read stories like this because there are these laws or whatever you'd call them. I'm not Catholic. I'm not sure what the phrase is. You know, within the religion that this
canon
is,
law. There is canon law.
There is canon law that this is wrong. And, you know, by saying that, this breaks up families. It even causes violence. I mean, there's a lot of bad things that happen by saying the way that you live is wrong. Yet people all across the world are living out gay lives. So it's like this thing that is happening naturally. It is a natural thing to be gay. You know, whether you believe that or not, there's way too many examples of it to oppose that. Yet there is this law that's saying it's bad and it's not okay. And just it's this nature versus culture situation where culture is making it dangerous and damaging, but it exists in nature. So I think that it's pretty hurtful, actually, for the Pope to say, you know, God loves gay people. It's just fine, but you can't get married. If he's saying it's okay to be in the relationship, to have children, he says not to deny them a family, then what's the difference between that and being married? You know, marriage is something
Rachel,
we made up as a culture. Having children is natural.
There's obviously no difference.
Right. So,
but this is how bureaucracies work, right? And there's no bigger and slower bureaucracy than the Catholic Church. The young Catholics of this generation, who in 20 years will probably be attending a gay wedding at a Catholic church, or maybe the new Reformed American Catholic Church.
Well, you know,
who knows how it'll pan out?
The church is not happy about the fact that a lot of people do not go to the church anymore, and they've basically given up on America and Europe. And I read, you know, in many places that they're focusing on Africa. That's where they're like recruiting next, you know. And the reason they are losing people in some way is because they're not accepting gay people. That pushes away gay people who still might think of themselves as Catholic but are not going to get married in the Catholic Church. And it pushes away people who, you know, are supportive of gay people, which in the United States, I'm not sure, feels like the majority. Maybe I live in a bubble. So I feel like, you know, if you want to welcome people in, you have to make it more hospitable. And they are certainly not doing that.
Yeah. Are you saying it's easier to be Jewish, Rachel?
That's exactly what I was thinking, but I didn't want to say. But, you know, I've learned over the years, I grew up in Reform Judaism, which, you know, there's different levels of Judaism, Orthodox being the most conservative. And so I grew up, when I would go to Jewish camp in the summer, there would be gay rabbis, women rabbis, everyone playing their acoustic guitar, and we'd be singing folk songs in Hebrew. So it wasn't honestly until my 20s that I knew that being an Orthodox Jew was very different and very conservative. And there's a couple documentaries you can watch on Netflix about how they're not super into gay people either. And there's a lot of abuse that can occur in these relationships. So I'm not excusing Judaism as a whole, but the way I grew up, very open, very cool.
Yeah. Well, you see, we're trying to keep the Catholic Church one universal Catholic Church. It's splintered enough already. You know that little thing in the Reformation? They don't want to repeat that.
I was going to say we all have matzo balls, but that's not even true because the Sephardic people have a totally different kind of food. So, yeah, we're all over the place. But you know what? Diversity is lovely, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.